The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Remember Trump himself? Why aren't you guys seizing machines? He says to the two Justice Department officials, Rosen and Donahue. So it's clear. And what was the obsession all about? It was all about these crazy theories about Venezuelan socialists planting secret algorithms in voting machines. You know, all nonsensical stuff. But it leads to this obsession that ultimately leads to the Coffee County raid.
I'm Anna Bauer, Lawfare legal fellow and courts correspondent, and this is the Lawfare podcast, January 31st, 2024. During a late-night press conference in August, an Atlanta-area prosecutor announced a sprawling criminal case against Donald Trump and his allies for their alleged efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election in Georgia. In a new book, investigative reporters Dan Kleidman and Michael Isikoff tell the story of the events that led to that moment and the local prosecutor behind it all. Lawfare editor-in-chief Ben Wittes and I spoke with Kleidman and Isikoff about the new details and insights revealed in their book, which is called Find Me the Votes, a hard-charging Georgia prosecutor, a rogue president, and the plot to steal an American election. In a wide-ranging conversation, we discussed the January 6th committee's role in the Fulton County investigation, Sidney Powell's request for preemptive pardons, Rudy Giuliani's plan to access voting systems in Georgia, and recent allegations that District Attorney Fannie Willis engaged in an improper relationship with one of her special prosecutors. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 31st, 2024. Find Me the Votes with Dan Kleidman and Michael Isikoff.
I want to start with the question of why Fulton County. You've got four major cases against the president, former president this year. This isn't obviously the most important of the four. Why did you guys choose to focus on Fannie Willis and the Fulton County case rather than, say, Jack Smith and the DC case or the subject matter more broadly of Trump's post-election conduct and the criminal cases that it engendered?
The easy answer is this is the most interesting case by far. Look, Georgia was ground zero for everything, for, you know, what we say in the book was, you know, arguably the most anti-democratic plot in history. It is where Trump was most focused, most his efforts, his pressure campaign was most intense, furious, and all-compassing. And also, it's worth noting, Trump did not act alone. He was not able to pull off what he tried to do all by himself. He had an army of Confederates. And that's why the Georgia case, which is a racketeering conspiracy case, is the most all-encompassing, going from the obvious, the pressure on Raffensperger and the phone call. And we have quite a bit of new on that, which I hope we'll get to, how that tape came about, for example. All the way down to a story Anna knows well, the Coffee County raid. And I think we shed a lot of light on how the various parts of this fit together. So we have Sidney Powell with our new reporting drawing up plans for criminal break-ins at election offices around the country to be with the operatives protected by hunting licenses, preemptive presidential pardons. And how it goes from that, articulated early on in the weeks after the election, to an actual break-in, the Coffee County raid, which has been charged as a case of computer theft. So you can see how all the pieces fit together best in Georgia. And I think it best illuminates the scope of what Trump tried to do.
Anna and Ben, let me make one other point about why we thought the Georgia story was so compelling. The human toll in Georgia went beyond anything we saw anywhere else. Trump's furious war in Georgia had appalling consequences for average Americans, innocent people victimized by his reckless conspiracy mongering. And you had officials at every level, from the lowest poll worker, people are all familiar by now with Ruby Freeman and her daughter Shay Moss, all the way up to the governor, subjected to brutal abuse, doxing, bombarded with frighteningly specific death threats, sickening racial attacks, unspeakable sexual threats of sexual violence. And it actually went beyond the elected officials themselves or office holders themselves, their families. Brad Raffensperger's wife, Trish Raffensperger, who we spoke to at length and looked at her text messages. You can't believe the onslaught of hateful and sexually violent messages that she got. And you know, this isn't just to tell a crazy story about what happened in the aftermath of the 2000 election. This is the country we're living in. And it is extremely difficult for the people that you need to protect us from these assaults on democracy to be able to do that when they're under this kind of threat. And it's going to continue. And so I think we have to look at a lot of the Republicans, we refer to it as the iron wall of Republican resistance in Georgia, who actually did stand up to Trump despite the brutal abuse that they got. And that's an important lesson going forward.
So something that really struck me reading this book, you know, there's a lot of information packed in there. And it's not unusual for prosecutors, especially elected prosecutors, to speak to the media or members of the press who are writing a book about a high-profile case. But something that really stood out to me as I read this book was how much Willis and her team were willing to tell both of you that is about their internal deliberations and decision-making that went on during the investigation of this case. And this is a case that has not yet gone to trial.
That part wasn't easy, Anna. Right. I will say it's not like they handed that out.
It's called reporting. And we did a lot of it. And they did not like just cough up all this stuff. It took a lot of work and a lot of piecing together lots of stuff. Yeah.
And it's fantastic that you got that access. It says, you know, a lot about your reporting. There's this one scene that just really stood out to me as far as, you know, what you were able to get about some of the conversations that were going on among prosecutors. It's the scene that took place the day the special grand jury heard the Raffensperger "Find Me the Votes" phone call for the first time. You report that Willis was there observing that day, and she later met with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade, who's one of her top deputies in the case, to discuss the jurors' reactions. You report that Willis said, "The phone call is good, but it's not enough." Clearly, the source for, you know, the content of that meeting is someone who's on the DA's team or who was present for that meeting. And it's frankly kind of astonishing to me that they would tell two reporters with a book coming out before the trial that the district attorney herself thinks a key piece of evidence is maybe not as strong as it's been made out to be. So the two of you have been doing this for a long time. You have a lot of experience working with prosecutors, talking to attorneys of all different types. What did you make of the kind of access that you were getting? And did you ever get a sense of kind of maybe why the DA and her team were willing to talk as much as they did about their internal deliberations and decision making, because this is now kind of an issue that's come up in the case itself, as Trump, in a recent motion, has argued that District Attorney Fannie Willis has been speaking too much in extrajudicial statements about the case. So kind of what did you make of all this as you were reporting it?
Well, just to underscore, I mean, this took a lot of reporting and a lot of effort. They were not willing to just divulge internal deliberations easily. But, you know how it works. You get a little bit, you push others and you get confirmation of some and denials of other aspects of it. But there is a lot of behind the scenes stuff here, but just tying in the first two questions, the one that Ben raised and when Dan was talking about the threats, the atmosphere, let me just take you to that scene that we start the book, which I think is one of the most astonishing, where on the night of the indictment, you were there, Anna, Danny and I were both there. We were all waiting for hours. She comes out the midnight press conference, finally announcing the indictment. And what happened after? They had gotten this threat, an assassination threat. You know, the best time to get her, to shoot her, is when she's leaving the building. Fannie Willis goes back from that press conference to her office, takes off her black business suit and pearls, and puts on sweatpants, a t-shirt, and a baseball cap. And then a body double on the staff puts on a suit matching what Fannie Willis was wearing, as well as a Kevlar, a bulletproof vest. And there's a decoy operation. The body double and a team drive out up from the garage where the assassination threat was suspected, and Fannie Willis is smuggled out the back door. That the threats of violence, the reality of what that means for individuals trying, in the prosecutor's office trying to do their job is so enormous. And can you imagine, by the way, Jack Smith or Merrick Garland having to be smuggled out the back of their offices after a press conference because of the threat of violence? But that's what we're dealing with in Georgia. And I think that, shows just how powerful and frightening some of this stuff is.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. One of the things that makes the book interesting is the apparent mismatch between the office and the project. That is, this is an office that, she runs for because she's interested in gang prosecutions. She's interested in street crime. She's not a national political figure. And,
And she's not a progressive prosecutor.
And she's not a progressive prosecutor.
Liberals, are going to learn from reading our book.
Yes. I actually thought that aspect was really interesting, that she's a figure who, notwithstanding her family history, her father, has quite the radical background. She is a pretty hardcore law enforcement type. And her office is reasonably well positioned to deal with street crime, but she has to bring in an expert on the RICO statute, which she's something of an expert on, but she's got to bring in somebody else. She's got to kind of think through these removal issues kind of for the first time. And so my question is, at the end of the day, is this a story about, the state criminal justice system and the county level criminal justice system in Georgia, backing up the feds in a real kind of show of federalism? Or is this a story about a mismatch between the highest of high crimes that takes place at the Washington level and a criminal justice system that's really geared up for, prosecuting local rappers who, also run guns, which is, another one of her big cases?
Ben, I would say that the indictment and the four plea deals since the indictment, and I think there are likely to be more, is a vindication of the ability of a district attorney. By the way, Atlanta is a major city. Fulton County is, most of Atlanta is Fulton County. So we're not talking about, some small town somewhere, but vindicates the ability of a district attorney to take on a case like this. This wasn't a case that she wanted. I mean, when she started the job, she was dealing with an enormous backlog of criminal cases. The office had been pretty terribly mismanaged by her predecessor, Paul Howard. She went through the process of actually interviewing every single assistant DA in that office to make sure that they had the quality of lawyering that they needed and that they could clear out the deadwood. So she, I think, understood even before she had the Trump case that she was going to have to build up that office. And then once she did, to go even further by bringing in people like John Floyd. And by the way, I think they were smart in also talking to others who had expertise in these kinds of cases. I'm not sure how much Norm Eisen, for example, was speaking to them. But Norm, someone who your listeners will be familiar with, and your colleague at the Brookings Institution, was writing, you know, very influential legal analyses of these cases. I know for a fact that they were paying close attention to what was in the Brookings report. And getting information elsewhere.
Yeah. I just wanted to add one more beat to this. You know, Ben said before that this is a prosecution for events in Washington. Actually, Georgia was the crime scene. Was the original crime scene.
That's an important point.
And I think, you know, one of the more illuminating parts we talk about, you know, the Raffensperger phone call was January 2nd. She starts, I believe, the next day. And, you know, the tape of the call is being played nonstop on cable TV. And people are dissecting the contents, like, what do you make? What did he mean when he said find the votes and all? What's Fonnie Willis thinking about? Where was Raffensperger when
Where
he took that
was
call?
Raffensperger?
Where was it? And he was at his home in Johns Creek, a wealthy suburb, but in Fulton County by just a mile or two. And she realizes once she learns that, that's my county. This happened in my jurisdiction. And that's what prompted her to launch this investigation.
Yeah. So the other person on the call is in Florida.
Well, one of the other people in the call.
Right. The third leg of the stool is in Florida.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Right. I mean, I think it was one of the great untold stories of this whole saga. And the woman we're talking about who was in Florida, Jordan Fuchs, who was the deputy to Brad Raffensperger, is, you know, I think some will, after they read our book, conclude that she is one of the unheralded heroes of this entire saga, because she makes the decision on her own, unilaterally, snap judgment, that she's going to tape the president of the United States without telling her boss, Brad Raffensperger, without telling Mark Meadows, who had beseeched her to set up this call, and of course not telling Trump. She puts herself on mute and tapes the call. Why? Because she was motivated by trying to protect her boss. She knew the dangers Raffensperger faced by having a conversation with Donald Trump during a time Trump is and his campaign is suing the Secretary of State, and knowing Trump's propensity for completely distorting anything that might be said, she made the tape as a protection for her boss. What she didn't know is that she was in Florida at the time, which is a two-party consent state. So it could be argued it was an illegally taped phone call. Now, if Florida prosecutors were to try to make an issue of this, I think she'd have a pretty good defense, because there's an exemption for law enforcement in the Florida statute, and the Secretary of State's office is a law enforcement agency. But this was concerning enough that she, through Raffensperger's office, deflected a request for her to testify before the January 6th committee. And when she finally gets subpoenaed by the special grand jury, she testifies under immunity and acknowledges that she taped the call.
So Ben mentioned, you know, this kind of question of fit. This is a county district attorney's office taking on a former president and his allies. But we learned from your book that the district attorney's office did have some assistance of sorts through the January 6th committee. That was a very interesting part of the book. Lots of new details there that I didn't know. And this is something that has kind of come up in the case recently as various defense teams have sought evidence or other correspondence or communications between the DA's office and the January 6th committee. So what can you guys tell us about this kind of, you know, communications that went on between the Jan 6 committee and the district attorney's office?
Anna, the first thing we learned was that the January 6th committee actually, for the longest time, wasn't returning the calls of the district attorney's office and following Willis's team. It took quite a long time before the chief counsel of the committee eventually did. He was being called by Mike Hill, who was the top investigator on Fannie Willis's Trump team. Eventually, Tim Hafey, the chief counsel of the committee, did call back and agreed to see a delegation from Fannie Willis's team. I mean, there's some suggestion out there, I think, from Republicans that this was collusion. This was just an investigation. The DA's office knew, as we all knew, that the January 6th committee had done a tremendous job collecting evidence and testimony and had uncovered a lot of new information, a lot of it about Georgia, that was going to be critical to this investigation. So eventually, they make arrangements for the DA's office, members of the DA's office, to come up there. But I will say that they first had to convince the chairs of the committee, and Liz Cheney in particular was not excited about it at first. And I think a lot of the reason for that was because they were worried that Fannie Willis's, that the DA's office might indict Trump before the committee finished its work and put on its presentation. And, you know, Cheney was, you know, politically minded and didn't want their thunder to be stolen. But in the end, they were able to convince her that the investigation was going to take, the Fulton County investigation would take much longer. There was no danger of that. And so they did come up, and everything that they saw was done in camera, essentially. They were not actually given any documents. They were not given testimony. They had to actually look at it on computer screens and take it down. But in the end, it was enormously useful to their investigation.
I assume we're going to at some point get to the Michael Roman motion and all the allegations that have been swirling about Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade. But one of the many matters associated with that that I think has been way overblown is the Trump people making an issue of that there were contacts with the January 6th committee and contacts with the White House, and therefore this shows some sort of collusion. Actually, the contacts with the January 6th committee, as Danny just explained, were just to take a look at what has become the entirely public evidence of what was in their depositions, what they had gotten. They weren't getting anything that isn't already out there in the public sphere. So the idea that there's some sort of collusion here doesn't really hold up. And the White House contacts are pretty simple. They wanted to interview former White House officials and former Justice Department officials, and you got to get approval from the current White House counsel's office to do that. It was not a swapping of evidence in any way. Yet, you know, you have the Trump people trying to make an issue of something that is really not at all out of the ordinary.
Well, since you mentioned Nathan Wade, yes. He plays a less than central role in the book, although
but
not
he's in
a
the
trivial.
Book.
I said a less than central role, but
yeah,
although non-trivial role. And one of the things I learned from the book, which is a little bit counter to the prevailing obsession with his relationship with Fannie Willis, is that he was like the third or fourth choice for that role. And I'm interested in your all's sense of which direction that cuts. I can kind of argue it either way, right? I can say, well, she goes for the big guns who, you know, are obviously qualified, and that shows that she's not particularly favoring the guy she's allegedly dating. And only when they turn her down does she sort of settle for a perfectly able, if somewhat underqualified, guy whom she happens to be dating. On the other hand, you could say, look, she asks the big guns. She knows what a qualified lawyer for this position looks like. They all turn her down. And then she goes for somebody that she whose major qualification, at least in this iteration, would be that she happens to be dating him, but he's manifestly less qualified than the alternatives.
Yeah, a couple of things about that. First of all, we don't know when they started dating. So, you know, it is, you know, I think there have been some representations from Ashley Merchant, who represents Michael Roman and who filed the motion with all of these allegations, that they were dating before. There's absolutely no evidence of that. And, you know, we've heard suggestions to the contrary, that it didn't happen until they started working together. But, you know, be that as it may, I think the thing to understand is, you know, when you put together a prosecution team for a case as complicated and high profile as this one, you know, I think you're hiring people for different jobs. And Nathan Wade, I think, was never intended to be the lead trial lawyer in this case when she finally did settle on it. He was never going to be the legal architect of this case. It was always anticipated that Nathan Wade would be a kind of more behind the scenes player. He does show up in court, but Anna knows this from being in that courtroom way more than I've been. He tends not to talk very much. He defers to the other lawyers on the case. He doesn't get involved in a lot of the complicated legal arguments. He is apparently quite a good manager of cases and a manager of lawyers and lawyers' egos, which is always important in these kinds of cases. Furthermore, he was managing the grand jury process. And we interviewed some of the grand jurors. These are the special purpose grand jurors, and they were actually quite impressed with Nathan Wade. One of them is a lawyer, and so he has some experience in this realm to make these kinds of judgments. You know, he was leading them through hundreds of witnesses, thousands of documents, and by all accounts did quite a good job. So you have to sort of put it in that context.
Yeah, just one story in the book, which is, I think, quite relevant here, which is that when Brad Raffensperger appears before the special grand jury and is testifying, and they get to the part where Trump is raising the prospect that he could be facing criminal prosecution, he, Raffensperger, if he doesn't do Trump's bidding and recalculate and find him the votes, one more than is needed to flip Georgia's electoral votes. And Raffensperger deflects. In fact, it was the lawyer on the special grand jury who asked the question, who was adamant about asking that question, said, did you take this as a threat? Raffensperger, who at this point, you know, he stood up to Trump's pressure, but he's very careful about what he says. He's still playing in the Georgia political world, planning on, at that point, running for reelection. And he kind of doesn't really give a straight answer. It's Nathan Wade who gets a copy of Raffensperger's book and puts up on the audio visual the passage in which Raffensperger said, yes, I viewed this as a threat of criminal prosecution by the president. So it was Wade who cleaned up Raffensperger's testimony.
By the way, one just detail about the lawyers who declined Fannie Willis's entreaties to come on board. One of them was Roy Barnes, the former and last Democratic governor of Georgia, and a real heavy hitter. I mean, he's not just a politician, but by all accounts, he's an extremely skilled lawyer. And a guy named Gabe Banks, who's a former federal prosecutor and a well-respected criminal defense lawyer, and someone that Fannie Willis knows well, both of them said no, in large part because of the threats they knew that they would get. In fact, we talked to Roy Barnes, and he said, hypothetically, would you want to have a bodyguard following you around for the rest of your life?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code Lawfare 20.
So I want to talk a little bit about what you guys call the raid in Coffee County in the book. You devote a whole chapter to
it. We figured you might have some interest in that, Anna.
I personally call it the Coffee County caper.
I think we use that word.
Yes, I think you do. Ben calls it Lafayette. What do you call it, Ben?
Lafayette Coffee.
Lafayette Coffee County.
Exactly.
You could at least say cafe.
Yes. Right. But whatever you call it, we're talking about the aspect of the charge conspiracy in Fulton County that relates to the alleged unauthorized access of voting systems in rural Douglas, Georgia, at the elections office there. As Lawfare readers and listeners know, and Dan and Mike, as you know, I've taken a special interest in this particular aspect of the conspiracy. And it's been something that in terms of, you know, reporting on it, over the past few months, clearly it's Sidney Powell is alleged to have been involved. She was charged. She pleaded out to charges related to the voting system breach. And you guys have this really fascinating reporting that you mentioned earlier that it relates to Sidney Powell and this plan to kind of break into voting system offices in rural counties. And there was a particular focus on Georgia early on. But something that I've been focused on in the past is this role that Rudy Giuliani potentially played in developing plans to voluntarily access voting systems, particularly in Georgia. There is this meeting that occurred between Giuliani and Kathy Latham, who is also charged in Fulton County alongside Trump, related to the voting system breach. That does not appear in the indictment, though, and Giuliani has not been charged in relation to Coffee County. So what can you guys tell us about, you know, Giuliani's involvement or potential involvement in the Coffee County escapade? And do you have a sense of maybe why it is that it was Sidney Powell, but not Rudy Giuliani, who were ultimately charged in with respect to Coffee County? Because that is an interesting question to me.
I think it's an excellent question, and I've wondered as well. You point out the meeting between Giuliani and Kathy Latham, who I think is referred to as a whistleblower at some point in the Willard Hotel. I think it was in the Willard Hotel War Room. We found on this podcast that Giuliani has that he's talking in, you know, barely disguised terms about Coffee County. I don't think he mentions Coffee County, but I think that interview, that podcast episode occurs right
around
the
time. It was on Steve Bannon's podcast.
It was Steve Bannon's podcast. And I think it's right before Christmas. And I think right after the meeting with Kathy Latham, in which he talks about, we've got something going on in Georgia, you know, that's going to, you know, take place behind Kemp's back. He's not going to know what's going on. It's crystal clear to me that he's talking about Coffee County. And by the way, and I think the January 6th committee uncovered this, there are also depositions in which, people talk about Giuliani bringing up Coffee County in the famous unhinged December 18th meeting where Powell and Mike Flynn and the others are trying to get Trump to use the military to seize voting machines. So Giuliani seems to be up to his eyeballs in Coffee County, and I'm not sure why the district attorney's office in Fulton County didn't go after him for that.
They may after they read our book, because I think there are additional details in the book that they are unaware of. But follow the bouncing ball here from Sidney Powell at the when they're at the Westin in Northern Virginia talking about the criminal break-ins and the pardons. Rudy thinks that goes a little too far. But the obsession with seizing machines goes all the way to the top. Remember, Trump himself, why aren't you guys seizing machines? He says to the two Justice Department officials, Rosen and Donahue. So it's clear. And what was the obsession all about? It was all about these crazy theories about Venezuelan socialists planting secret algorithms in voting machines, you know, all nonsensical stuff. But it leads to this obsession that ultimately leads to the Coffee County raid. One more beat on Coffee County. One new piece in the Coffee County chapter is the Chris Harvey memo. Remember, the defense to the Coffee County is, well, we were invited in by the Misty Hampton and the Republicans in Coffee County. There's this memo from Chris Harvey in November. Chris Harvey is the state elections director for the Secretary of State's office. He's hearing all this nonsense about Dominion machines, and he's getting worried that somebody's going to try to access those voting machines, which have confidential, critical infrastructure about voting that, if got exposed, could, you know, allow hackers to break in. And he sends this memo to every state county election director in November that says explicitly, and it's underlined, you may not release any of the voting machine data. You cannot release it under open records request. You cannot release it under any circumstances. He drew a bright line. He said he did it to prevent exactly what took place in Coffee County. So the idea that there was a permission to go in for this case of computer theft doesn't really hold up at all.
I want to talk about the personality of Fani Willis. You spend a lot of time in the book, among other things, painting a portrait of her and her story as a prosecutor, as a lawyer, as a politician. I was really intrigued the day that she showed up in court to argue pretty routine. It was the gag order motion, and she showed up and argued it herself, that this is a first-rate trial lawyer, you know, who, like, she is way better at arguing motions than any of her staff, and is actually a hugely impressive just force in a courtroom. So, you know, backing off of this case for a minute, who is Fani Willis? And she's kind of your main character in some ways, other than the fact that Raffensperger happened to be sitting in Fulton County. You know, how did she end up being where she is?
Well, first of all, you use the word force, a force in the courtroom. She is, as many people have described her, just a force of nature as a personality. Larger than life, and has the kind of confidence and bravado sometimes of a truly talented trial lawyer.
But I just want to say, because sometimes when you say somebody's larger than life, you don't think of them necessarily as a detail person who's going to come in and argue a motion in, you know, at that level of granularity. And she is a fabulous technical lawyer, among other things.
Absolutely. And you know, we have some great stories about, you know, some of her courtroom exploits that go to that. I will say, my expectation all along from talking to people around her was that she was going to play a significant role in trying this case herself. I would not at all have been surprised if she had done the opening. I would have fully expected her to do some of the witness questioning. And, you know, we'll see what happens as how all of this plays out since the controversy has erupted. But I think if she hangs on, we will see a lot more of Fani Willis in the courtroom. Look, she is a fascinating woman. She is the literal daughter of the civil rights movement. Her father, who I think people may have begun to hear a little bit about, was a founder of the Los Angeles Black Panther Party. That was an offshoot of Huey Newton's party. But he was a gun-toting Black Panther and then eventually became a civil rights lawyer and a criminal defense lawyer, lived in Washington, was in D.C. Superior Court, Ben, when you and I probably were covering some of those trials many years ago. And Fani Willis was a little girl, 5-6-year-old girl, living with him. He raised her as a single father, which was pretty unusual in those times. And she used to come down to the courthouse with him to arraignments. There's a famous story of her when her father is in the back in the cell block interviewing potential clients, and she's sitting up there on the bench with a gruff D.C. Superior Court judge. And at one point, she says, "You know," he says, "step him back," which is courthouse parlance for, you know, take him back to the jail. It was that moment where she decided she wanted to be a judge. She told her father, and we interviewed her father at great length about this. Interestingly, he said to her, "Well, if you want to be a judge, you're going to need to be a lawyer first." And years later, he, the former Black Panther and criminal defense lawyer, convinced her that she should become a prosecutor, that that was the clearer path to becoming a judge than to be a defense lawyer. He was so supportive of her and so close to her that he thought that being a prosecutor was the way to go, even though he had been a civil rights lawyer and a criminal defense lawyer himself. Mike, I don't know if you want to talk about her path to this job, but her courtroom abilities were pretty stunning. And we have, Mike, you want to tell the story of the bitch is a genius?
Yeah, look, I mean, she was, you know, I think said before, the star litigator in the Fulton County District Attorney's Office. And the word for young lawyers is, if you want to know how to do a homicide case, go sit in and watch Fani Willis do it. You'll learn something from that. Talk about some of her exploits in the courtroom, but the one that is maybe the most fun is she gets a hold of a jailhouse tape of one of her defendants trying to make sure a witness potentially against them gets out of town, so Fani Willis can't put the witness on the stand and interrogate her. And the guy says, "The bitch is a genius," as the reason he doesn't want the witness on the stand. Fani Willis gets a hold of that, plays the tape, has a field day with it, and then her then boss, Paul Howard, gives her a plaque, the Bitch is a Genius Award, which she loved and would often show off to others.
The other thing to know about her is she is a preparation. This goes to your point, Ben, about her being detail-oriented. She is a preparation freak with incredibly high standards for her team. And we have scenes of when she's in college doing moot court competitions where she was locking herself in a room and you know, you couldn't get her away from studying, and she prevailed in these competitions. But we have a scene in the book where a few months before they were ready to bring the indictment, she wants to go over all of the evidence that they've compiled. And so Nathan Wade brings in all of the other members of the team. They do a PowerPoint to show the individual targets and what they have. And she starts, it's like a Supreme Court oral argument. I mean, before they can get a word out, she starts grilling them. You know, "Well, what document do you have to prove that? You know, what do you know about this?" And a couple of minutes into it, she looks at them and says, "You don't got this, you know. You know, this is effing terrible. Get the F out of
here." She kicks them out of her office, including Nathan Wade. She kicks Wade out of the office, says, "This is terrible."
And then she storms out herself, leaving them kind of dazed. They go back and do a lot more work. They come back and represent it to her. She said to us, "It was better. It was a C." Pause. "It was actually a C-. She is a workaholic and a crazy about getting it right and getting the details right.
Yeah, I mean, I found that scene really interesting in light of my experience watching her, which was that there was no question that she was not prepared for. She actually didn't prevail on the motion, but it wasn't because she didn't have answers to questions. It was because Judge McAfee is an independent mind who's, you know, had a different instinct about the thing. But it was interesting to read that section in light of watching her. This is a highly, you call her a preparation freak, and this is somebody who is herself very prepared and does not seem to have a lot of patience for staff who are not entirely prepared.
I think we quote her saying, you don't get awards around here for participation. I'm not from that generation. That is vintage Fonnie Willis.
All of which just underscores what a disaster it would be for the case if she were to be disqualified, because it would basically shut the case down. The whole office would then be disqualified, and they'd have to find new prosecutors who have no background in the evidence, no background in the grand jury testimony. And it would delay things, you know, certainly well beyond the election, but probably much longer than that. I don't think that's going to happen in any case. I don't know what Anna's take is. You know, we're going to see this week Fonnie Willis's response for the first time to the motion filed by Michael Roman, but I would not be surprised if we see a vigorous response that disputes at least some of what has been alleged that's out there.
Well, it may dispute some of what's been alleged, but I think it's going to be even, you know, really vigorous on the law and on this question of whether the facts alleged represent a conflict of interest that would disqualify her.
The conflict of interest theory behind this case just strikes me as so far-fetched. The idea seems to be that because Nathan Wade was getting paid by the Fulton County District Attorney's Office and they went on vacations together, in which at least some things that Nathan Wade paid for, they had a vested interest in keeping the case going and prolonging it so they could make
and
money.
Keeping the case going against Mike Roman.
Against any of them. It's preposterous. First of all, there's absolutely no evidence to back up what is being alleged there about that this was a motivating factor. We went through every decision that was made in the course of this case, and, you know, we dissect them, and it's pretty reasonable. One can understand why each step was taken at each direction. Remember, at the beginning, she doesn't get any cooperation. People are demanding subpoenas if they're going to testify. She's got all these regular grand juries that are dealing with murders and rapes and gang warfare that doesn't have the bandwidth to do an in-depth investigation. She finally gets the special purpose grand jury. They take months and months because it's a long, complicated case. But, you know, the underlying claim in the Roman motion just doesn't seem to add up at all to me.
All right. I want to zoom way out to close, which is to ask you, you've got a million scoops in here. You've got a million details that nobody knew before. I want to ask the so what question that, you know, what is the big lesson here of this story that you have this crazy set of schemes that are all related to keeping Trump in power. That was the gravamen of the indictment. You have this story of a force of nature Atlanta prosecutor who comes to power on the back of the flop of her predecessor, which we didn't talk about, but who then kind of inherits this case because it happens, one end of the call happens to be in Fulton County. And you have the development of this case alongside the Justice Department's investigation and the January 6th investigation. For the person who looks at this and says, I don't care about Atlanta, I don't care about Georgia politics, I care about Donald Trump and democracy protection, what's the importance of this story?
Look, there are a lot of different ways to answer the question, which is a good question, Ben. But what I would say is for those people who are worried about Donald Trump and worried about democracy, they ought to be worried about Donald Trump's ability to slip noose after noose. And that if you're going to actually protect democracy and vindicate the importance of the rule of law. Sometimes you need a multi-front offensive, and under our system of federalism, it's not just the feds and the feds. You'll look at Jack Smith's case. I mean, it's a very, very narrow case, and it does not encompass the broad scope of criminality that we saw in the post-election period. Georgia does much more so, you know, from everything from, you know, the lying to state officials to the threats against the horrific threats against people to Coffee County, to the fake elector scheme. And that wide scope of alleged criminality, I think, is really important. Two other things that I would say, echoing things that I had said before. One is the human toll in Georgia. I think it is really important for people to understand that what Trump and his cohorts did in Georgia had a profound effect on large numbers of individuals, on just regular Americans, citizens, poll workers who were just doing their jobs, the wives and husbands and children of elected officials who were doing their jobs. This is something that all Americans, I think, ought to care about, because it's not just some far off thing where people who are involved in politics are at risk here. It's really all Americans. The tech worker there was a young tech worker for Dominion in Georgia, who, because, and this gets to the next point I want to make quickly, because Ron Watkins, one of the key QAnon figures, some people think he was Q himself, tweeted out a bogus a video alleging that this tech worker was manipulating voting data. This guy came under horrible assault. And to this day, as we understand it, is still suffering from the sort of PTSD effects of all of this. And I mentioned QAnon. This is also about what could happen in 2024. So we spent a lot of time writing about Lynn Wood, for example, who was a celebrated trial lawyer. You know, everyone remembers him from the Richard Jewell case or JonBenet Ramsey, and then eventually goes down the QAnon rabbit hole to the point where he is tweeting that Mike Pence is going to be executed by a firing squad and Chief Justice John Roberts is involved in pedophilia and sex trafficking of children, a cornerstone of the QAnon conspiracy. Well, all of this was riling up people in Georgia and around the country and had real consequences. QAnon sort of has faded a little bit from the national consciousness. We don't write about it as much as we did in the aftermath of the 2020 election, but these dark forces are bubbling beneath the surface. And guess what? We are about to have a rematch of Joe Biden and Donald Trump in the presidential contest. And that is going to fulfill the prophecy of the QAnon crowd. And you can bet that Donald Trump is going to be tapping into that paranoia and legitimizing those crazy beliefs. And that has the potential to cause more violence. And so this isn't just a colorful and exotic story about conspiracy theorists. This is an important story about what could come next.
Mike, bring us home. There is something fitting that this case has been brought in Georgia, a state that straddles the fault lines of American politics, by a local DA who is literally a daughter of the civil rights movement, who has shined light through this case and all its ancillary waves on the racial dimension that underlay so much of what was going on. The Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss story, two African-Americans who become the brunt of the targets for Trump's Stop the Steal nonsense and bolstered by Rudy Giuliani and all the others. There's a racial element there that you cannot escape. And, you know, in some ways, the fact that it's Fani Willis who has brought these charges, I think, speaks volume and is, you know, could well be, depending on how things play out, a very American story.
We are going to leave it there. Mike Isikoff, Dan Clydman,
The book is Find Me the Votes, A Hard-Charging Georgia Prosecutor, A Rogue President, and the Plot to Steal an American Election. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is edited by Jen Potya-Howell, and your audio engineer today was Ben Wittes. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.